This WBEZ podcast is supported by Hacia, whose Executive Fellows Program provides Black and Latinx business owners with real-world tools and strategies needed to master fundamental management concepts related to company stability and growth. Registrants learn through one-on-one executive coaching sessions with subject matter experts in the areas of finance, business development, operations, and legal. More info at haciaworks.org.
WBEZ is supported by Chicago Humanities, presenting live events with historians Doris Kearns Goodwin and John Meacham, comedian Reggie Watts and filmmaker Miranda July, and artists Hebrew Brantley and Amanda Williams in conversation. Plus, MSNBC chief correspondent Ali Velshi on small yet powerful acts of courage throughout history. Tickets for these events and more conversations on arts, culture, and current affairs at chicagohumanities.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. This week was a doozy, but never fear, the weekend is almost here. Before we wind down for a few days, it's time to get all caught up with our weekly news recap, where we cover the top stories in our area that you might have missed. From the release of body cam footage.
The deadly Chicago police shooting of Dexter Reed is bringing the department back into a national conversation.
To former Mayor Lori Lightfoot coming back into the spotlight.
Former Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot is taking on a new role.
She's been tasked with investigating possible financial misconduct by an embattled South Suburban mayor.
To Illinois lawmakers looking to reduce plastic in the state.
An Illinois Senate proposal to ban single-use toiletry containers from state hotels is now moving to the Illinois House.
This week's panel includes Crane's Chicago business government and politics reporter Lee John Greco, ABC 7's 5 and 6 p.m. newscast anchor Revy Beishwal. And joining us for the first time on the weekly news recap is Chicago Sun-Times reporter Andy Grimm. We started with Andy telling us about Dexter Reed and walking us through what that video shows.
Dexter Reed is a 26-year-old man who was behind the wheel of a white GMC Terrain driving through the 11th Police District. The Harrison District's one of the most violent historically across all the police districts in the city. And this area of this that he was stopped in is also considered a high-violence area. There's a great deal of shootings in the 11th District. But apparently what prompted him to be pulled over was just a seatbelt violation observed by some officers on a tactical team that were, five officers piled into an unmarked vehicle. They curb the vehicle. They hop out. They are trying to get him to roll down his window, get out of the vehicle. The officers are shouting at him. Guns are drawn. And at some point, a shot is fired apparently from inside Reed's vehicle, striking an officer on the passenger side. And then that touches off a immediate shootout. And for over a period of about 40 seconds, there were more than 90 shots fired. Mm-hmm. And an officer wounded in the wrist. And Reed was eventually shot as he tried to get out of the vehicle.
Yeah. You mentioned there that we hear an initial gunshot, and it apparently comes from inside the vehicle. Are you hearing any doubts, though, Andy, about CPD's account of the sequence of events and that Dexter Reed fired first?
So there is a memo from the director of the Civilian Office of Police Accountability that does question the officer's rationale for the initial stop, questioning whether they would have been able to see through the tinted windows of Reed's vehicle that he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. Also, the demeanor of the officers. They also raise questions about the volume and the proportionality of the response. A single officer among the four that did fire their weapons fired, they said, 50 times, including 3 shots after Reed appeared to be immobile on the ground. Mm. As far as whether or not Reed fired first, that does seem to be the conclusion preliminarily of COPA's that is in fact true. There is an officer with a bullet in his arm, and we have body-worn camera video. We also have surveillance footage from like a Ring camera or surveillance camera from a house across the street that gives a pretty good perspective. Does seem like there's some sort of like a puff of smoke from the window and then preceding all of the other shots.
Now, this is all in the hands of COPA, the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, and the state's attorney to decide whether these officers acted reasonably. Let's play a clip here of King Fox.
It is in these situations, when deadly force is used, that the need for accountability becomes even more paramount. It will be our job, based on the totality of the evidence, to determine whether the use of force in this case was beyond that force which is allowable under the law.
Any idea when they'll be done investigating this?
These can take a long time. The video was released, you know, within 3 weeks of the shooting that took place by COPPA. The investigations can take much longer, criminal charges longer still. You know, it's certainly moving a lot faster than another controversial police shooting where the volume of gunfire was questioned. That would be the Laquan McDonald shooting by Jason Van Dyke. So it's hard to say. I have talked to experts in use of force, and, you know, the law is very favorable to officers. So long as they say they were in fear of their life or their safety of themselves or others, they are justified in firing their weapon. And in most cases, the courts find that it doesn't matter whether you shoot once or a dozen times.
Yeah.
But of course, we did see in the case of Jason Van Dyke, criminal charges were filed and he was eventually convicted.
I do wonder, though, Andy, I think something worth noting is those five officers were already under investigation for another stop involving a seatbelt violation. Do you think like that's something that will take into account in that investigation at all of this shooting?
Yeah, well, certainly I think that's going to be a factor in any sort of disciplinary investigation and in the action by the department. The department policies can be much more strict as far as your conduct in a stop than even than the law. And of course, like the probable cause question was raised, I guess, in a previous stop by this same unit. Mm-hmm. You know, another thing, we mentioned there are a lot of gunshots, there are a lot of shooting in the 11th Police District. That police beat, it was the scene of seven different police incidents where officers fired their weapons, right? So there's a lot of action in that area. And these teams, there's also one of the, there are more traffic stops in the 11th District than in any other district of the city.
I find what's remarkable is we start to have a few days now that have passed since that video came out. And the discussion around this is how quickly the issue of police reform has become part of the discussion as much as it has been the tactical use of guns in that very difficult district. And remembering that at least at this point, it's pretty much established, it's not completely proven, but it's established that the first shot came from inside the vehicle and a police officer was shot in the wrist. So that whole discussion about, well, what can a police officer do when they are fearing for their life, when they're doing their job, has instantly become part of the narrative around whether this was all justified or not. And for a lot of people in Chicago, I think the idea that, okay, a police officer has been shot, all the rules kind of go out the window at that point. It's interesting to see that that is not necessarily what is happening here. That might be a function of what happened, of course, with Laquan McDonald. Maybe something about how the city has evolved.
I want to talk more about community reaction here. Dexter Reed's brother, 24-year-old Julius Reed, he was arrested during a protest on Tuesday night. What happened there, Andy?
He had joined a protest that formed outside the Harrison Police District offices in response to the release of these videos. The officers say that he hit and shoved a police officer. He was arrested on a charge of battery and resisting arrest. And somewhat controversially, was held overnight, processed through the jail. He could have, you know, potentially been released from the station even with those charges pending. But you know, he was just one of many people there at a protest. And I think, you know, what we saw in Laquan McDonald, you know, wasn't necessarily immediate. There were protests the night of that were pretty contained outside the police station. Then we saw the Black Friday protests in downtown Chicago that were much more animated, much more high profile. You know, we'll see what the weekend bears. I'm sure there are things planned. It's going to be lovely weather. You know, this was Julius Reed. His family has been very much engaged with the media and trying to keep a focus on this case and making sure that the investigation proceeds.
Well, sticking with the Laquan McDonald comparison, I know you covered that case back in 2014, Andy. I'm curious how you think it compares both in how police behaved and how the city handled it.
Well, again, you know, we're seeing like the Laquan McDonald, that was it 11, 13 months before the video was
13.
Released?
Yeah.
And there was an election in between.
Indeed, there was. There are new entities to deal with police accountability here. COPPA released the video immediately, raised questions about the stop, and it does seem that there's going to be a thorough investigation. Some of the things that I think that we're seeing, too, is the presence of body-worn cameras where we're able to see what happened, and it's not just the officer's account of what happened. So I think there are some elements of reform that are at work here. We have a state's attorney who has said they are investigating this for, you know, for presumably it sounds like she's talking about excessive force, not just, you know, a criminal charge that would be, you know, something like manslaughter or murder, as in the McDonald case. As to what, you know, we have seen as a nation a great deal of anger in the streets over policing. From where I sit now, this does not seem to be a George Floyd moment. But I think that it is continues to show that there are still a ways to go, because I think what people are asking, what I hear people saying is they stopped this guy for not wearing a seatbelt, and it suddenly escalated to 100 shots in the air.
At that same press conference where we just heard from Kim Fox a moment ago, faith leaders were there questioning why plainclothes police officers would pull someone over for not wearing a seatbelt. I mean, are you hearing some similar sentiments, Ravi, from community activists as well?
Without a doubt. They are ready to speak about that in large measure. Also, I was struck by the video of this entire exchange, because in the first part of the video, you see this white car, which has been curbed, which Dexter Reed is in, and it actually has a very pristine kind of quarter panel and door. And then in the next video or two or three shots later, it's literally just shattered with bullet holes all the way through, which gives you an indication of how much force was brought to bear in that moment. But again, what I think is really remarkable here is there isn't a lot of argument about where the first shot came from. And if a Chicago police officer is shot, what are the rules then? I mean, that's where the narrative changes quite differently from other situations we've seen with Laquan McDonald, with George Floyd, and so on and so forth. And I think that that speaks to where sort of society is in terms of trying to comprehend what actually happened here, what is wrong here, what needs to be dealt with in terms of reform. That reform question came up instantly.
Yeah. Lee, community activists and faith leaders, too, they're also questioning whether Dexter Reed might have had doubts about whether those were, in fact, actually police officers just because they were in an unmarked vehicle. Do you think perhaps we'd hear more about this?
I'm not sure in that sense about those doubts, and I think that's very hard to know, given obviously Dexter Reed can't speak to that. I'm interested kind of looking forward how the new state's attorney is going to handle this. This case is coming at a really interesting transition point from Kim Fox, who has had this very progressive agenda, and Burke doesn't seem like she's going to be quite as progressive, although she has said that, you know, things like the Safety Act, she still stands by those. On the question of the traffic stop itself, too, this was something that a reporter at WBEZ was talking about this morning, that basically traffic stops have gone up while stop and frisks have gone down among CPD. So there's basically just been this trade-off. So kind of looking at those trends, I think, will be interesting. I don't know, Andy, you probably have more to dig into there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that may be the debate that we have is, you know, about these pretextual stops. I mean, obviously, these are traffic violations. My colleagues, when I worked at the courthouse, that were public defenders, when they have a gun case and somebody's pulled over and they find a gun after they've been, you know, they failed to signal or at a stop, they will then request the videos to watch the previous, you know, half hour or so for those officers, and they will see dozens of traffic stops. And I have talked to folks who, you know, say that they're stopped, you know, weekly, several times a month. And there is a lawsuit pending from the ACLU about these stops because they're happening in predominantly minority neighborhoods.
Yes. The question is that's being raised is who gets pulled over?
But also who is making the stops? Back to the reform question.
Yeah.
These tactical groups, these quick response groups, they're what, four or five people, as you said, in an unmarked car, jumping out with heavy machinery, practically militarized, and they're in already an area that has a reputation, the 11th District.
Yeah.
They're obviously where the hot spot is, which is a long-term way of policing here in Chicago.
Yeah.
And getting inside that question, I'm still struck, though, by the fact that even if the first shot came from inside, that there is a question about what that police response needs to be. And again, that's what makes this a national story. It's been amazing to see in the 24 hours after this happened how every network, every cable network had experts from all around the country talking about this and how it was happening in their neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, it was
as
in the New York Times, all the papers.
And I think the video was pretty compelling, that part I talked about earlier, but it really is something that society has to wrestle with. What can police do when they feel they're under siege?
On the topic of who gets pulled over for these traffic stops, two important stats to note. The ACLU, as Andy brought up, they've reported that 63% of traffic stops in Chicago target African Americans, even though they make up only 30% of the population. Also, the 11th district where this happened has the highest number and percentage of traffic stops. I want to play a little bit of what Brandon Johnson had to say. He was at Tuesday's press conference as well.
Because the people of Chicago deserve to have awareness and full knowledge of police shootings. When someone is shot and killed by police in our city, my administration will lead with transparency. Attempts to withhold or delay information are mistakes of the past and we have already taken concrete steps to start a full investigation into this case.
Again, alluding to the 13 months that it took to release footage of the Laquan McDonald shooting. Ravi, do you think that this, you know, prioritized transparency from the mayor, that it impacted how the public reacted? Us being able to see this just, you know,
yes,
so quickly after
yes,
March 21st.
And I think that that sense of expectation was there after Laquan McDonald. It is obviously something that Mayor Johnson ran on and spoke to in terms of how the city needs to do its business. So he had to respond as kind of on point as quickly as possible. And in his very first utterances about this, saying it's never acceptable to shoot a police officer and Chicagoans deserve to have police that are operating in the most fundamentally fair manner. It was in practically the same sentence. That to me was a change in what the expectation is around how police matters ought to be governed in the city.
Yeah. What is the latest, Andy, on the officers involved in the shooting? Starting with the one that was shot in the wrist. What's his status?
Well, he appears to be recovering.
Okay.
And if you watch the video, you know, he's obviously in pain, but seems to be fine. It was a shot in the wrist, and he was running around at the scene. You can see that.
Mm-hmm.
The officers have all been stripped of their police powers. Now, typically after a shooting, officers are supposed to be stripped for 30 days, just mm-hmm. while an investigation is conducted.
And that's happened with all of these officers, yes?
Yes. I'm not clear on whether or not they will be stripped indefinitely while the investigation is pending, especially given COPA's recommendation was that they strip them and that there were these concerns about the probable cause for the stop, the previous
right.
incident, the single officer firing, you know,
so
50
many.
Rounds.
Yeah. Yeah. Community activists are calling for the officers to be dismissed.
Yeah, which is a long process that may get longer, but that's another story about the union contracts and labor law here. But yes, that
you briefly mentioned use of force earlier. You've been looking into data on this in the 11th District. Can you tell us a bit more about what you found out and you talked with experts?
Yeah, so I spoke with the use of force experts about the stop itself. You know, I think a lot of people look at this, again, the context that we have is that this was about a guy not wearing a seatbelt. Experts that I spoke with just sort of questioned, he said, you know, every indication from the way they got out of the car and the officers and the way they immediately, one officer pretty much has his gun trained on the vehicle the entire time. It appeared to him that this was a person that they had some knowledge was armed, potentially dangerous, whether they stopped him for a seatbelt or not, if that was the pretext that they had thought something was up.
Mm.
But he still felt that the way you would still conduct this would be to summon a uniformed officer in a marked car to do the traffic stop, that this would somehow de-escalate the situation. The person inside the vehicle would know who is there. You know, it's hard to tell from the video, you know, how clearly they announced their office or, you know, and from what his perspective was. I mean, you mm. know, they are wearing...
That's actually one of the big criticisms, right, about these strike forces, that mm-hmm. the whole issue of de-escalation, which was an enormous lesson learned supposedly out of Laquan McDonald, does not seem to be part of the standard operating procedures of these groups that go into those tough neighborhoods. So there's a hole in terms of application of police reform in that regard.
Yeah.
Whether
yeah.
it's justified, that's again, I mean, the police
remains
union would say,
answered.
Wait a second, you know, walk a mile in the shoes of those police officers and see what it is that they're feeling and seeing and knowing and doing and what kind of intelligence they have. So
yeah.
it gets down into that granular analysis of what's gone on here.
Yeah, I think that was part of what struck me about watching that video was sort of that immediate level of aggression as they came out the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, followed by the 96 shots that you hear
right.
when you watch this is...
In 41 seconds.
It's stunning. And I say that not in a... You know, it's just shocking, and it's hard to watch, and it's difficult to hear that.
So hard to watch. I refuse to watch it. I have not. I have avoided it thus far. Mayor Johnson plans to ask the city council for $70 million to pay for migrant services. Lee, this is a shift from his earlier position, right?
Yeah. So as you may recall, back in February, there was a big press conference that was pretty controversial because earlier in the day, Governor Pritzker and Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle had announced they were going to allocate over $320 million toward the migrant crisis. And what was supposed to happen was that essentially Cook County was supposed to throw in $70 million, the city was supposed to throw in $70 million, and then the state was supposed opposed to kicking the rest. But it was very strange that this announcement came from Pritzker and Preckwinkle, but the city itself was left out of this. And so when there was a press conference later that day at City Hall, everyone was asking, hey, is the city kicking in their part? And yeah. Johnson basically said, what $70 million are you talking about? I have no idea. And now all of a sudden, that $70 million is back on the table. And it seems that next week, City Council is going to vote on that. My colleague, Justin Lawrence, and I have been reaching out to alders on this. It looks like that money will not come from ARPA. Those are the federal funds, the federal COVID dollars that the city has dipped into earlier for the migrant crisis. The city has said, you know, many times since then that they're not going to use any more COVID dollars for the migrant crisis. So it seems that this money is going to come out of the city's general fund. Now, you know, whether City Council actually allocates that remains to be seen. There are a lot of folks that say, hey, we need this money for the crisis. But on the other hand, I think you're going to see the usual suspects come out and argue against this. The Black Caucus has been very upset over allocating more money toward the migrant crisis, saying, hey, you know, South and West Sides have long been ignored by the city. Why are these new folks suddenly getting this money? Yeah. So I think it'll be interesting to watch.
Do you think, Revy, that the mayor's anticipating more migrants will be sent to Chicago as this DNC approaches?
Well, he better be, because that is exactly what everyone is planning for.
Yeah.
And the optics of that for the Democratic National Convention, which is coming up in August, are going to be too compelling for the governor of Texas, for example, to not ensure, I would guess, that many buses are sent into Chicago, to underline what has happened with immigration policy in America. And I think that, by the way, that convention is going to be front row center Chicago in world news, like for days and days and days. At least that's what we're planning for. In terms of how it affects city politics and some of those constituencies you talk about is fascinating in and of itself. But I was struck by what the governor said. Like, let's be clear about how we're helping these migrants. No one's living in luxury here. We're giving them like food and coffee and bathrooms.
The bare minimum, the bare necessities.
Two showers a week, that kind of thing. I mean, it's our collective humanity.
Also, these migrant shelters are not in great shape, as we have seen with the Pilsen migrant shelter. There's measles outbreaks that are going
on.
The 5-year-old who died of sepsis that, you know, had multiple complications, including COVID. It's a dire situation.
Right. And the response on that human level is what we're talking about. But that being said, there's no question that this is going to get more intense as we go through the spring and summer.
And the city of Evanston is also debating how it's going to help migrants, right, Revy?
That is a big story. And again, this is something that I've been waiting for this to kind of happen in the suburbs. Why is it always just a Chicago arrival position? Why is that where all the services are that are going to help these migrants? In Evanston, there is the same discussion that happened, maybe four to 6 months ago here in the city about where do we house migrants? Where are they moving? I live in the northern suburbs. You see the presence of migrants on city street corners and in very suburban settings like you didn't see 6 months ago.
So Evanston's proposing a couple of sites?
Yeah, they're talking about a site on Church Street in Evanston that is not ready to house human beings, at least in terms of the repairs that need to be done there. They're also talking about housing them at the Civic Center, the old Evanston City Hall, because they're actually, that building is quite decrepit, and they're actually moving city staff out of Evanston and putting them in other office situations and office buildings in the city to do their work while they supposedly fix up this old city hall.
I see.
But now they're talking about making that a temporary shelter for migrants. There are lots that are coming there. And it goes right to the issue of such a progressive place like Evanston having to live its values about, well, where do we respond on that human level?
Mm-hmm.
And the people who want to be seen to be on the right side, the correct side of that equation, at least in their minds, there's a culture of that in Evanston, but it's butting up against the impracticalities
right.
and the difficulties of that.
As we're talking about the suburbs, good timely to get an update on former mayor Lori Lightfoot. We're going to head to South Suburban Dalton. There's a lot of drama happening in that village. Let's start with allegations of financial impropriety.
Yeah, so the mayor of Dalton, Mayor Tiffany Henyard, has been accused basically of, you know, lavish spending on, you know, flights to Las Vegas, you know, hotels there and everything. And so the village trustees have called in Mayor Lori Lightfoot. She's putting on her investigator hat here. They have hired her to the tune of, I guess, $400 an hour. To investigate the mayor. And, you know, it's really interesting. You're kind of seeing what seems to be the downfall of one mayor and perhaps maybe a little bit of a comeback show for Lori Lightfoot. Yeah. They had, I think it was, the meeting was on Monday where they approved hiring her for this. And, you know, it seemed that everybody erupted in, you know, just support for her, which, you know, I'm sure Lori has to be loving that after the year that she had last year.
Did you see the look on her face in that video? Yeah. There is no question that she's walking around in that little council and Henyard's over there
so
going.
It was a little moment, yeah. for sure. There's a separate civil lawsuit that was filed on Monday against the mayor and one of the village's board of trustees, Lee.
Yes. So, one of the village trustees, Andrew Holmes, has been named in a sexual assault lawsuit. And so that lawsuit alleges that Holmes assaulted a village employee on a trip to Vegas, and it claims that the mayor retaliated against the employee and a police officer when she learned of those allegations. Allegedly, that employee was fired and that officer was taken off the mayor's security detail. And that is also supposed to be part of this investigation that Lightfoot is going to do as well.
WBEZ is supported by Chicago Humanities, presenting live events with historians Doris Kearns Goodwin and John Meacham, comedian Reggie Watts and filmmaker Miranda July, and artists Hebrew Brantley and Amanda Williams in conversation. Plus, MSNBC chief correspondent Ali Velshi on small yet powerful acts of courage throughout history. Tickets for these events and more conversations on arts, culture, and current affairs at chicagohumanities.org.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Hacia, whose Executive Fellows Program provides Black and Latinx business owners with real-world tools and strategies needed to master fundamental management concepts related to company stability and growth. Registrants learn through one-on-one executive coaching sessions with subject matter experts in the areas of finance, business development, operations, and legal. More info at haciaworks.org.
Let's turn back to our current mayor, Andy. He missed a deadline involving an oversight board for the police. What's that about?
Yeah, the Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability is one of many new layers of police accountability. This is a board that was supposed to consist of seven commissioners that are nominated by the 66 members of the 22 different police district councils.
Okay. I'm trying to sort that through in my brain here.
Many layers.
Lots of
this.
Oversight. Yeah.
But point being was that these folks are to be appointed from a list generated by the district councils. They have given their list of names. I believe it was 14 nominees, and the mayor was to select, or might have been 15. The mayor was to have selected seven to appoint to full terms. There is an interim board in there, and this board has taken some action. You know, it has been involved in the hiring of the superintendent, Larry Snelling. They were the ones behind the department's scrapping of their gang database, which is very controversial. They issued a formal ban on officers associating with hate or extremist groups.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they've been doing work. There are folks there in an interim capacity. I believe the person leading that board now is among the nominees, but they were to have been picked, I guess, April 7th, and that deadline has lapsed.
Right, and that interim board appointed by Lori Lightfoot.
Yeah.
So that's still, there's still some progressive piece to that, given what you just said in terms of what they have actually done.
Yeah, and Lee, this isn't exactly a new issue for Mayor Johnson, right? He's been criticized before for being slow at filling some key positions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, early on in his term, he argued, hey, we're trying to get our feet under us, give us some time. And yet he seems to still make that argument today. I mean, the mayor just celebrated the 1-year anniversary of his victory in the primary last year. So you know, he's almost a year into his term now, and he still has positions that either he hasn't filled or that he took a very long time to fill. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, they announced that they were going to have a chief homelessness officer in the fall, and they only filled that position until fairly recently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are other major positions that I think folks in Chicago don't really think about day to day, but are very important for the city. For example, the federal affairs position, that's essentially the lobbyist for Chicago. They are based in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And their job is to interact with the Illinois delegation on Capitol Hill in D.C. and also all those different federal agencies that are very important, you know, bringing the pork home, so to speak, but also dealing with crises like the migrant crisis right now. And so they have someone in that position, but it's not official. They're still just an acting position. And so, you know, I'm just not really sure what's the holdup.
There's also been a switch at the chief of staff position, right? I mean, Richard Guidas, who was a well-known hand at City Hall, worked in all kinds of different departments. He headed up emergency operations and communications. He was considered to be a steady hand to help a new mayor understand the machinery of civic government.
Mm-hmm.
He's gone. He retired. And so
Christina Passione's eyes.
CPZ, that is the initials. There was JFK, there was LBJ. Apparently now there's CPZ.
Now there's CPZ.
And she's, I know her very well. I would like to think I'm one of the first people to help get her some exposure in terms of television as an advocate for the Puerto Rican community, the Latino community, and the Humboldt Park and the West Side. She's very capable, very strong. She's a former state senator. She has a learning curve as well as a chief of staff. So that's all part of the growing pains, I think, too.
I do think, to your point about, you know, Rich Guidas leaving, everybody expected Rich Guidas to leave. And, you know, the rumor was basically that CPZ was going to take over for him eventually. I think there was some talk about, oh, maybe it'll be COO John Roberson. But it was assumed that CPZ would take over. I think the question was more so, will he leave before or after the DNC? Everybody thought he was hired for that chief of staff position because of the experience that he had at OEMC. I did ask Christina Passione Zayas about that last week when I interviewed her for my profile, saying, you know, hey, are you worried that there's no one at the helm that has that OEMC experience before the convention? And she ticked off, you know, a list of people in the Johnson administration that she believes have enough experience. But, you know, I think that'll remain to be seen, I guess.
All right, let's jump quickly to Springfield here before we take a pause. They're considering a bill that has to do with teacher evaluations, Lee. What's that about?
Chicago public school teachers, they use this evaluation. It's called the REACH evaluation. And critics, you know, chiefly the Chicago Teachers Union, have said that these evaluations are biased against Black teachers. You know, there have been multiple studies, at least two studies on this, one from the University of Chicago, that have pointed out that Black teachers in CPS will score lower on these REACH evaluations than their white peers. But those same studies pointed out, well, those Black teachers are also overrepresented in schools that, you know, are in poorer communities. So the argument is basically, well, they have the deck stacked up against them because they're dealing with students who have less resources themselves.
Yeah.
And so this proposal from Cam Buckner would give the Illinois State Board of Education the ability to examine teacher evaluation procedures and determine if, quote, there are racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, or geographic factors that undercut how these CPS teachers are rated. And then if they determine that there are these biases, then the Chicago Board of Ed and the CTU would negotiate to create a new evaluation system. Mm-hmm. The other thing to kind of think about here is that CPS is worried that this is basically a go around the negotiations that are supposed to happen between CPS and CTU, those contract negotiations. And Cam Buckner pushed back against this, saying, you know, hey, we've done this before. Bills have come out of Springfield that, you know, give teachers more leeway to negotiate around layoffs and that sort of thing. But I do think this is part of a broader strategy from Stacey Davis Gates, who has said, that she is going to take her fight when it comes to these contract negotiations to Springfield and to D.C.
Right. Let's close this section of the recap, Andy, with a very different story. A man was released from prison after serving 11 years for a wrongful murder conviction. Quickly walk us through this case and what's next for the 31-year-old, Anthony Robinson.
Yeah, so Anthony Robinson was injured in a shooting. He was wounded himself in late 2012. And then in early 2013, he was arrested and charged with the murder of another man by the name of Kelvin Jemison. So this was out in front of the Washington Park homes, allegedly. The police said that Anthony was seen by witnesses jumping out of a car, chasing this guy down, running down Kelvin Jemison, shooting him, killing him, and then running back, getting in the car, and driving off. Now, I mentioned that Anthony had been shot in the leg and suffered serious injuries, shattered bones, pins installed. And however, his attorney at trial did not think that this was a hugely important thing because the person that was walking with Kelvin Jemison, his friend, recanted his identification of Anthony Robinson as the shooter, as did two other eyewitnesses who said that the shooter had short hair and Anthony Robinson had shoulder-length dreadlocks.
Right.
So I guess his trial lawyer thought we're probably okay. So at a bench trial, based on those recanted identifications, his co-defendants walk off. But unfortunately, the judge convicted him, sentenced him to 55 years in prison. Subsequently, the x-rays were introduced as evidence, and a doctor said that he probably couldn't have walked without crutches.
Right.
And so he did get out, and that was one of...
Wow. Yeah. What a journey. We also want to mention a loss this week. Many are mourning the death of Cook County Clerk Karen Yarbrough. She had a long career in public service, including as a state representative and Cook County Recorder of Deeds. So our thoughts are with her friends and family. All right, time to turn to what's become our weekly sports stadium update. Revy, what are the latest developments with the Chicago Bears?
Which team, amateur, professional, college?
I only have time for the Bears today, so give me the latest developments.
The Bears have had some discussions with the city officials who would be talking about some sort of subsidy from the city and what might go into some kind of a deal to be able to make something happen on the lakefront again. So the lakefront option seems to be leading once again, despite the best hopes of the city fathers and mothers in Arlington Heights, where they actually bought the old racetrack there for $326 million. But it appears that there's some advanced discussions happening that there would be a deal for a new stadium that would involve some $2 billion worth of private money through the Bears. But be very careful about how the language is used here. That does not say that that's the total budget for it. That does not say that there is going to be an ask for public money in whatever this project ends up looking like. And there's no question that those who want to protect the parks and those who want to protect the lakefront are going to have their say in all of this. So that is going to evolve over the next little while.
In other development news, we learned construction of the Obama Center can continue in Jackson Park, right, Lee?
Yes. So this was U.S. Appeals Court that issued their decision. This lawsuit was against, for some reason, Secretary of State Pete Buttigieg. I'm not really sure. But in any case, it allowed the construction to go through. This three-judge panel said, we hope this will be the final installment in a long-running challenge led by a group called Protect Our Parks. It was kind of an exasperated decision that came down from this panel, to be honest. The more I cover these lawsuits, the more I see that, like, a lot of these judges are really snarky. But essentially, Protect Our Parks was arguing that, you know, the Obama Center has no place in Jackson Park. It should be on public land. They have been suing over this since 2018 now. And so maybe this is the end of the road. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we will see construction end in 2026 now.
Which is now the new goal, right?
Yes.
The new target. Let's turn to something different, Revy. Mayor Johnson renewed his call for a ceasefire in Gaza this week. This was while attending an Eid festival marking the end of Ramadan. And Palestinian supporters, I mean, they're turning to him for additional political support, right? Can you fill us in?
Exactly. And I think that this underscores where the discussion is around this entire policy around the ceasefire and how the Hamas-Israel war is playing out in terms of local domestic politics in America. We see that on a daily basis, or certainly on a weekly basis, there are demonstrations downtown in support of the Palestinian part of this equation. And certainly on the progressive side of politics, and especially within the Democratic Party, that voice is incredibly strong. It's getting stronger. You're seeing the kind of impact that that's happening, having in terms of looking at what the whole presidential race is going to be looking like coming down the pipe. So Mayor Johnson has waded in on this and has made it very clear that he sees that side of this equation. And I think it does speak to where we go with this issue over the next 6 months, leading again to what's going to happen at the Democratic convention.
Yeah, pro-Palestinian protesters, they want him to intervene so that they can march closer to the DNC headquarters in August. The city denied their earlier request, citing safety concerns and traffic concerns. And the city proposed an alternative route in Grant Park.
Can I just say
3 miles away.
This is so important because as we get ready to start to cover that Democratic convention, we in our newsroom are trying to figure out where do we want our people to be? Do we want to be inside or we want to be outside?
There's going to be a lot happening at the same time.
I think the DNC people want you inside where they can contain everything.
Right.
Because basically nothing is going to happen inside McCormick or inside the United Center. I mean, we know who the nominee is going to be. Conventions are not like they were decades ago where there was any drama. All of the drama is going to be on the outside now. And so whether it's, you know, protests around what's happening in Gaza or, you know, maybe with the migrant crisis, that's where you're going to want your folks to be.
Student debt. I mean, we're seeing that. All these progressive issues are surfacing.
Speaking of the nominee, Lee, tell us quickly, why was Joe Biden in Chicago this week?
He's got to get that money.
Fundraising.
He was over at Michael Sack's house for a small fundraiser with 40 people. And as you mentioned, there were also protesters outside. They were protesting against President Biden's support for Israel and Gaza right now. And before that, he was in Wisconsin announcing, you know, new student debt forgiveness. Of course.
And for those who don't know, who's Michael Sacks?
He's not only an investor here in Chicago, but he is also a major player in Democratic politics and fundraising. He used to be a World Business Chicago, and he is heading up the fundraising for the DNC here in Chicago. So this was, you know, a fundraiser for Biden, but also, you know, getting together some of those key folks that are going to bring home the bacon, so to speak, for the DNC here.
Right. So I want to return to Chicago politics for a second. A city council committee passed an ordinance allowing people to ride electric scooters anytime they want. Apparently, at the moment, you are not allowed to ride them between midnight and 5 a.m. Thoughts, Andy? I mean, have you been tempted to ride a scooter home from, say, a bar at 2 a.m.?
I think the people that are tempted at to ride a scooter at 2 in the morning are probably the last people that should be riding them.
So you think this is a good idea?
Yeah, I would like, if they could keep them, like, off the sidewalks, generally speaking, you know, 24 hours a day, I think that that would be the thing to tackle first here. I don't know that we need late-night
scooter.
That
is so hard to police. I was in Portland last year on a story, and it was just... It was really hard to walk on the sidewalks. I was in Indianapolis just over the last week, and same sort of thing. I mean, there are no rules of the road, it seems, for a lot of folks.
I don't think most people know that they can't ride the scooter between midnight and 5 a.m., though.
But now they can.
Now they can. If you don't want to ride an e-scooter home from your late night out, you might soon have another option, Ravi. What's Uber's app doing? It's changing.
They are making it such that you can actually call a taxi, a good old-fashioned taxi on the Uber app. It will be like having an Uber X, so a little bit more expensive. It's an attempt to sort of obviously cast their net wider. Mm-hmm. We talked to a number of people who drive cabs in the city yesterday, and it seems that their reaction to this is split. It would mean that they presumably would have more customers to choose from, but it also gives Uber and its market position more power in terms of determining the cost of rides and so on. So I don't know if it's hard to get an Uber or hard to get a taxi, but it's all kind of morphing into, it seems to be trying to morph into one experience.
Yeah. Well, I want to end the recap with your reactions to the celestial story that eclipsed all over the news on Monday. I mean, I saw it from our patio here at Chicago Public Media. Ravi, you just mentioned you went to Indianapolis, and I have a feeling that's the reason why.
Oh, yeah. You know that what they say in our newsroom, it's what kind of a day are you going to have when you're going to Indiana? But at any rate.
is that what they say?
Oh, yeah. Okay. You're going to Indiana. So sorry. Don't mean to offend everyone from Indiana. But my wife and my daughter and I went down to Indianapolis, actually Shelbyville, Indiana, 20 miles southeast of Indianapolis, and to be right in the middle of the zone of totality. And I have to admit, I'm a total eclipse nerd. I went down to Carbondale in 2017. Folks, It was mind-blowing. It was like looking, I don't know if you're spiritual, if you're religious or what have you, but it was like looking when it actually happened.
Yeah.
In that zone of totality, the moon comes over the sun, everything changes, and it's like you're looking, if you will, at the face of God. It is unbelievable, the energy. The energy, the light changes. All of a sudden, you're in this, essentially, this. It feels like a giant diorama. There's Mercury. There's Venus. Here's Earth. We're standing on Earth. There's Jupiter. There's Saturn. It all lines up just the way.
But can you see the other planets?
You can see it. You can see it as clear as day.
Oh, wow.
You can practically see the rings on Saturn if you've got really good glasses on. But it's because of the way the light changes and kind of the refraction of the light, for lack of a better term. But for me, personally, I started to cry. My wife immediately started to cry. And it's because it's like a confirmation for me of where we are in the cosmos. And in fact, here we are. We're here on Earth, and it's actually all true.
I mean, it was amazing.
Folks, go to that zone of totality once in your life, find it. The difference between that and being 99.9% beside it, it's all the difference in the world.
We'll have to leave it there. Incredible experience. Thanks for tuning into the Weekly News Recap. My thanks to Ravi Baishwal of ABC7, Chicago Sun-Times, Andy Grimm, and Lee John Greco from Crane's Chicago Business. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Enjoy the weekend. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guffman. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. The news cycle moves fast, so our weekly news recap gives us the opportunity to slow it down. If you enjoy our recap as much as we do, well, consider leaving us a rating and liking this podcast. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around the city. Thanks for listening and have a restful weekend.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.